This week on Reality Check on KCIW, we're interviewing history teacher and long-term civil rights activist Robert O'Sullivan to talk about the history of the civil rights movement. And thank you for being here, Robert. You're getting to be almost a regular. I appreciate that. You were even at the March on Washington in 1963, is that right?
Yes, I was, and it might be of value to speak in some detail about that. The march was the brainstorm of a man named Philip Randolph, who was the president of the sleeping car porters union, which was a large black union. That
was one of the first unions ever, wasn't it?
It was certainly one of the first black unions. Sleeping car porters played an interesting role in that they were few blacks who were able to get a job that wasn't manual labor or hard domestic or factory work, but it also got them around the country.
Yeah.
In fact, it's interesting in the history of Oakland, it became a city with a fairly large black population because it was at one end of the Southern Pacific Railroad and the other end was New Orleans.
Right, that explains a lot.
And they populated the area right near the train station and things like that happened. But anyway, A. Philip Randolph was a major figure who first thought of a march on Washington in the early 40s. Mm-hmm. And there's always been a conflict, or those days there was a conflict, between civil rights leaders and the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party had all those Southern senators and congressmen who had enormous power and had to be dealt with somehow, and who were able to even filibuster against legislation which would have made lynching a federal crime.
Mm-hmm.
The March on Washington was during the Kennedy administration. Kennedy was a reluctant friend of the civil rights movement and moved way too slowly as far as many people were concerned. And they actually kind of agreed to making the march possible in physical ways, but reserved the right to cut off the speaker of the big speakers if any of the messages got too radical.
Interesting.
That's free speech for you.
yeah, definitely.
But well, it was a happy event, good music, Mahalia Jackson, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Joan Baez, and a lot of good entertainment and a very peaceful and friendly day.
It was considered to be a real landmark occasion, though, for the size of it and maybe other things as well.
250,000, probably 50,000 of which were white people.
Mm-hmm. Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's start from the beginning of the civil rights movement here in America, because I know we can go back and talk about Gandhi and people like that, which would be really interesting to do too, but let's talk about, you know, we had a whole civil war about this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then there was, you know, what do you call it when the carpetbaggers were there? I forget the word.
Scallywags and all that.
Anyway, you want to start from the beginning pretty much and fill us in a little bit, just briefly?
Well, it's a lot to cover. I mean, slavery was an awful thing. It was also a money-making thing, the slave trade itself and the use of slaves. The Civil War was fought largely over the issue of slavery, and as you said, you thought it should have been settled then. It wasn't. There were times not long after the Civil War that there were black senators and there were black congressmen and people in the state legislatures. But that was all killed off by about the 1870s or so.
What did they call that period? I'm blanking on the name.
The Reconstruction.
Reconstruction, yeah. Thank you.
And then post-Reconstruction.
Right.
And it became a really sad and ugly time. The Ku Klux Klan became organized and was a dominant force in much of Southern life. For a long, long time, black people in the South who showed any uppityness, and that could be in all sorts of different forms, were realizing that they could be terrorized, and terrorized by that institution known as lynching, mm-hmm. which was commonplace in the South, but curiously also in northern cities. Anyway, Jim Crow laws were put in, which allegedly were to make things separate but equal for whites and blacks in the South, but were far from that, and which had been supported by a very bad court decision in 1896 called Plessy versus Ferguson, which said that as long as there are separate but equal facilities on trains and in
right.
public facilities, that was all right.
That would be it, yeah. And there was a lot of betrayal on the part of the government, too, where I remember it was like 40 acres and a mule was promised
alleged,
and didn't happen.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Alleged. You don't think that was actually true, maybe?
No. Well, we're quibbling over words here.
Okay.
That was something that was true as far as I know, but it was alleged in the sense that they weren't serious.
Right.
In much of the South, the sharecropping system developed, which was almost a new form of slavery
mm-hmm.
in many ways. It made blacks dependent on not a master anymore, but on someone who owned the land or leased the land and made sure they were paid and fed and this and that. But interestingly, part of the ugliness of those days in the South was major migrations to the North started mm-hmm. happening. Much later were super important migrations.
We're talking
to
like
Chicago and
the turn of the century period.
Yes,
it happened over a period of time. Yeah,
yes, at the turn of the 20th century, was when those migrations were starting. They got much bigger in the 20s and 30s and. Mm-hmm. 40s and so forth, but the North was hardly a pleasant place for most black people either. What basically gave impetus to the civil rights movement was actually a court decision by the U.S. Supreme Court under Earl Warren that overturned the Plessy versus Ferguson decision on separate but equal, and said that that's inherently impossible, and that black.
What year would that have been?
What year? Yeah. 1954.
So really, half a century later.
Half a century later, there had been organizing of all sorts of civil rights groups. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was the most prominent. There were other groups as well, and up until the time of World War II, there were efforts to organize, but it took that Supreme Court decision to give the kind of hope that, hey, things are really likely to change. It's turned out to be a bitter hope in many ways, but it was a unanimous decision that did indeed change the direction of American national life.
I can only imagine with 50 years of basically segregation,
mm-hmm.
How, you know, culturally it was just everything that people assumed was true about this world, you know. And then having that court decision would have maybe woke people up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, to a Southern white, they would think about just keeping a way of life. This is the way everybody wants it, and don't intervene from other parts of the country to say this is wrong. Just leave us alone. And it took ugly forms. The Klan often had members who, during the day, would wear the black robes of judges or the blue uniforms of cops, but during the night, they'd wear the white robes of the Klan
mm-hmm.
and terrorize people with burning crosses, lynchings, and all sorts of ugliness.
Tell me, if you will, about there were lynchings and so forth, but in terms of how black folks lived in those days, I mean, there were poverty stricken oftentimes, true, but also, you know, in terms of their rights, did they feel, in the South, like there was they could stand up for themselves in anywhere? Was that just completely out of bounds?
It was extremely difficult. People knew the possible consequences, and they were ugly. They realized that the system was just like a casino where things were always wired to make sure that things went a certain way.
Yeah.
And in major counties in the South where there were significant black populations, you could often find, and this was really until the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act of 1965, you could find entire counties without one black person registered to vote.
Wow.
And if they couldn't register to vote, they also could not be on juries. They could also not express votes for their friends and colleagues. And it was a system terribly rigged against them. And it took some very brave men and women to realize how wrong it was and to come up with ways to try to change the system without creating all sorts of bloodshed. Mm-hmm. And here is where the life of Martin Luther King Jr. becomes so important. He was a promising young man, got out of high school early, I think at the age of 12, got out of Morehouse College at the age of 19, got out of seminary at the age of 22.
Wow.
And in the process, especially when he went to a white seminary in the North, he learned about Gandhi and what had gone on in India, starting in the late 20s and early 30s, and learned how people were willing to commit themselves to disciplined nonviolence, but also a nonviolence that pushed the issue in taking direct action to do things like sit-ins and other mass events to kind of shut down cities and governments and eventually in India, the entire British Empire was humbled in a way that it never had been humbled before. And there were others that had influence with King who also were deeply influenced by Gandhi. After he finished at Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, he went to Boston University School of Theology to get a graduate degree in that area and eventually got a doctorate there. And he came under the influence of a man named Howard Thurman, mm-hmm. who was dean of the chapel there and a mystic and a poet and a very creative churchman. He founded one of the first deliberately integrated churches in the country in San Francisco. It was called the Church for the Fellowship of All People. And he also had gone to India firsthand, saw what Gandhi was doing, and again, deeply influenced King by sharing from his vision and his knowledge.
Wow. So you were talking about Howard Thurman,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very familiar name. Why do I know that name?
Not sure.
Okay. Well, just start from the top. Howard Thurman, you're going to tell us about him.
Yeah, was visited Gandhi in India and was a very creative preacher and charismatic friend to not only to King, but a lot of other key people in the civil rights movement. He was kind of their spiritual guru in many ways, as well as Benjamin Mays, who was the president of Morehouse College, where King had gone as a uh-huh. as an undergraduate, who also was sophisticated was helping King to develop a vision of what he thought his life should be like. A little more about King is, as a young man, he probably could have had a very comfortable life. His father already had him as an assistant pastor. He was hooked into the black establishment in Atlanta, which had Morehouse College and Spelman and a fairly moneyed and substantial black middle class. And he probably could have had a comfortable life there. Mm-hmm. But he was given a call to Montgomery, Alabama, which had been at one time the capital of the Confederacy, and a place with a history of really strict Jim Crow division of water fountains and restrooms and public facilities and many of the indignities that life in the South involved for black people. And it was there that he was not long before he was drafted into becoming the head of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and the Rosa Parks incident happened.
Which was pretty much the beginning of the civil rights movement in America,
right? That and that court
right?
decision. They were around the same time.
53-ish?
Yes. And the result of Rosa Parks was a sophisticated woman who'd been involved in civil rights for a long time. There was a school for teaching nonviolence and teaching organizing tactics in Tennessee called the Highlander Folk School. And at one interesting week, there were three people whose names became pretty famous. One was Pete Seeger, one was Rosa Parks, and the other were Martin Luther King. And she was the secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery, and a lot of people kind of say she was a simple seamstress. Well, that's
not really.
That's not a good concept anyway. I know too much about seamstressing to know it's not simple. She was a civil rights activist all her adult life.
So the picture I'm getting is that there already were these undercurrents going on, mm-hmm. but I guess not really getting national attention, maybe being pretty underground at that point.
And just one day, she was tired. A black man got on the bus and wanted her seat, and she said no. And it was a short little encounter. The police,
a black man got on the bus?
No, a white man, excuse
me. That's what I thought.
Got on the bus and took her seat, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. She was arrested, and the organization that happened in Montgomery was extraordinary. Pretty soon, there was virtually nobody showing up for work. Because,
so the response was a general strike?
Well, it was more a bus boycott, but when the buses were boycotted, the maids weren't going to the
right.
rich people's houses and all that. Although pretty soon, there was organization of carpools in which a lot of the white women were involved because they wanted to make sure they got their help.
Right.
there was even a movie made about that.
So, oh.
But anyway, King was the right person at the right time. He had extraordinary oratorical abilities, but he also learned something about organizing and was someone committed to nonviolence and committed to direct action and committed to confronting evil in ways that help the people who have to be confronted to maybe get out of it with some grace.
You're listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. And we're talking with Robert O'Sullivan about the civil rights movement, the history of that, and some of the experience that he had along the way being part of it. So King is now getting really out there active with the Rosa Parks incident, as well as it sounds like the whole town of Montgomery.
It was quite an event, and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in their favor, and all of a sudden bus companies throughout the country had to no longer have such things, and other things, lunch counters and bathrooms and whatever, were becoming a subject of change, although it often had to be prompted by students who were willing to sit in or engage in some very risky behavior like the Freedom Rides.
Tell us about that.
Must have been 63, 64.
Mm-hmm.
The people realized that Greyhound and Trailways and other bus facilities in the South were segregated, and a series of white and black riders, usually associated with CORE, that was a Congress on Racial Equality,
right.
Were willing to ride those buses and integrate the facilities and in the bus stations and face the consequences with using nonviolent means. And in one case in Anniston, Alabama, the buses were burned out and they were almost killed. And there were ugly things happening, like the FBI was tipping off local police as to where the bus was going to next and where one might be a good place to intercept it and set it on fire. And there were things with law enforcement then in the South that were really ugly. And the FBI had a director, J. Edgar Hoover, who was a terrible racist.
Yes.
And a great enemy, the greatest enemy of the civil rights struggle.
So for people that maybe weren't alive back then and didn't get a lot of it in school, what would you say to them about how these organizations came to be? I mean, how did people get involved and what would they go through to learn to be, say, for instance, a freedom rider or something like that?
Well, it took some knowledge of what was going on. For black people, that wasn't difficult because they experienced it at all times. But for many whites, it was something that took a lot of learning and maybe a little humility and honesty that they weren't used to on such subjects. A lot of white people were taught that African Americans were of an inferior race, that they're less intelligent, and there were also ugly sexual stereotypes about them and how they conduct themselves, and a lot of suspicion of their motives, especially related to white women. And also, unless people happen to be in a school or a job site where there was integration, very little contact, even in the North, between races.
You can see that today in a different context, where we all live in our own little bubbles and don't know much about the other side, unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a lesson for today about how badly things can get out of hand.
Yeah. And also, in the mass media as it was developing, television becoming in most people's household, radio before it, there was either ugly stereotypes about race. There was the Amos and Andy's program. There was no presence of a black actor or artist, and there was a lot of discrimination in those fields. And I remember growing up, I was somewhat late to get TV in my home, but until Nat King Cole had his own show, hardly seen anyone on television. And even the NFL and the NBA.
Right, even the ball teams weren't integrated.
Yeah, were the Boston Red Sox, I forget exactly how long it took them, but it was like in the middle 70s. Yeah, 25 years after Jackie Robinson with the Red Sox, or 20 years maybe. Even the NBA was originally a white league that had very few black players in it at all.
Hard to imagine today.
And politics didn't have many people of color who had any presence.
Especially strange, since they had been in politics right after the Civil War, and then that just died. This would have been the period of time where you were starting to get involved, I imagine. Why don't you give us a little color about what your process was like and how you got swept up in it
all? My youth involved quite a bit of church activity.
Mm-hmm.
I aspired to the Lutheran ministry and was a leader in church youth organizations for a few states and was quite involved in that. And also just by paying attention to what the Christian faith should be all about, recognize that one should see everyone as a child of God, and that one should show love and compassion and openness, and especially to those who are hurting, and especially to the stranger and those who are different. And because of all of those things, I got involved.
Were you seeing it on television? Were you hearing about it at school? How were you getting the exposure?
Some at school. But and also I was in school in Oakland and living in Berkeley, and Berkeley was we're talking late 50s now, starting to be a hotbed of organizing. It wasn't really until the mid-60s that things got very hot there. And incidentally, the free speech movement, for which Berkeley is so famous, was directly related to the civil rights movement. The university was not allowing organizations to raise funds for the Mississippi Summer Project and voter registration projects in the South. And students thought they should have the right to not only raise funds, but have free speech in that area. And so it was directly tied to the civil rights struggle. And the civil rights struggle had many students, white students, who were convinced that racism was wrong and that injustice is wrong and something should be done about it. And that was a big part of the 60s and something that I was part of myself.
So going back to Martin Luther King and Montgomery, what is the sequence of events coming from that point forward? In terms of, I mean, it was Selma, there were a bunch of different things, but I'm having trouble putting it in context.
I'm not sure if I have all the dates still straight in my head, but the bus boycott was late 50s, and things started happening in various parts of the South that sometimes were successful, sometimes were woefully unsuccessful, as an effort in Albany, Georgia, to fill the jails, and the local people just wouldn't budge at all, even though King and others were trying hard to make for changes there. I knew of a Lutheran pastor who was about 65 years old who got arrested for civil disobedience in there, that was a tough struggle.
I'm a little bit confused about the details here. You're saying that in this place in Georgia, there was like a movement amongst the whites to arrest a bunch of people. I don't know the whole story of that area.
I wish I could remember quite the details of it, but in a lot of cases, in Birmingham and other places, the fill the jails effort was something that was really successful in getting support.
So this would be on the part of the racist people.
The civil rights people would commit acts of civil disobedience and get themselves arrested.
So they were filling the jails on account of they wanted to make a splash in the media.
A splash in the media and make it hard for the city to keep functioning, its jails to keep functioning. Well, in Albany, I think they kept arresting people and then letting them out right away.
Right.
And so that they were kind of being slick in how they were defeating the principles that had worked so well in some other places. 63 is the March on Washington, and it wasn't terribly long after that that some tragic things happened. The bombing of kindergarten or young girls in a church in Birmingham, where four of them were killed, and murder of Medgar Evers, lots of terrible things happening in various parts of the country. But the president, Lyndon Johnson, recognized, much to his credit, that although it would hurt the Democratic Party in enormous ways, that something had to be done on the federal level to guarantee the rights of black people. The 64 Civil Rights Act covered things like public accommodations, which were important, use of restaurants, and use of motels and hotels and all of that, but they got that through Congress, but couldn't get the voting rights element part of it in the package. And it was only because of Selma in 65 that indeed was a new Voting Rights Act, and that changed the South.
Let's talk about Selma. Give us some detail and background. What led up to that?
Selma is a county in Alabama that back through the civil rights, or before the civil rights era, was very, very segregated, strong Ku Klux Klan presence, and a strong effort to keep blacks, quote, in their place. And one of the ways, of course, had to do with voting. And as I mentioned a bit earlier, you couldn't vote in the South, or you couldn't be a member of a juror in the South unless you were on the voting rolls. And they kept people from being on the voting rolls by saying, you need to take this literacy test, and you need to do this task that is impossible for most people to understand. And in Selma, interestingly, because of my own heritage, which was Lutheran, there was a Lutheran college there. And some of the people at that Lutheran college were blacks who were educated there and then came back to teach there, who were among the early leaders of trying to get voting rights there. And for a while, there were only like 120 blacks on the voting rolls in that county, but that was 128 more than in some local counties where there were zero numbers on the voting rolls. And anyway, if you can't vote, you can't have a whole lot to say about what your community is like. And that's part of why Selma became so important.
And they did it through... And where you can't have a jury or peers or anything. I mean, that's terrible.
They did it through nonviolent resistance after a terrible bloody Sunday in which they were on a bridge trying to cross it and were just attacked by police with billy clubs and horses and German Shepherds. I shouldn't mention the breed of the dog. I happen to be very fond of that particular breed and have three. But anyway, and the governor of, at the time, George Wallace, was blatantly racist. His inaugural address included the words, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And his police were the ones who, state police, who were the most guilty of what happened on that bloody Sunday. And it hit the news throughout the country, even interrupted some movie programs on the few networks that existed then. And pretty soon, people were responding from throughout the country to go to Selma and join in a march between Selma and Montgomery, the capital of Georgia, where they had planned to march. And in my view, it was one of the great days in what now we call progressive Christianity, of Christian folk who, and Unitarians and others who just recognized that it was very important to be there and to say human rights should be for all people. People should have the right to vote, to participate in their community and its decision making and its choice of leadership.
Yeah. You're listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. And I'm talking with Robert O'Sullivan, a longtime civil rights activist and teacher of history. So after Selma, so that was a real high-profile event, and then the march took place.
Mm-hmm. And not terribly long after it, the Voting Rights Act passed Congress, and... again, the dominance of Southern white racists in the Senate especially was never again as strong. But all of a sudden, the Republican Party was very willing to offer a racist alternative for people who wanted to find their home there.
Is that when the South being Democratic flipped to being Republican?
Yes.
I didn't know that. I always was curious about what happened that it made that happen.
Well, the Civil Rights Movement was successful. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were passed.
And so Johnson was blamed for that.
And Johnson said, we shall overcome. And he recognized that the country could not continue the way it was and that basic justice was important to happen.
And he was a Southern Democrat.
And he was a Southern Democrat himself and was intimately involved in the power structure of the Senate when he was majority leader. And yet he at least had the insight to recognize what he had to do there. It's too bad he was so wrong on the war in Vietnam. But that's a whole other issue.
That's another story for another day.
I thought I might mention a personal experience or two that dramatized, in one case, quite dramatically, what being a white person concerned about civil rights, wanting to identify with the movement and all that, was like in my early 20s. I wound up going to a rather unusual school in Indiana. It was no longer exists, but at the time it was designed as a sort of a pre-seminary for college students who wanted to be Lutheran ministers. Mm-hmm. And it was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and quite a contrast to what I was used to in Berkeley and Oakland. But I brought my kind of organizing self to that place, and pretty soon Ross Barnett, who was the governor of Mississippi, was coming to town to get Northern support for his keeping James Meredith out of the University of Mississippi because he was black. And anyway, I was a principal organizer of quite a few students to come with picket lines to this particular event, and we made quite a splash in the local newspapers and on local television and that. And anyway, we thought we did a good job and glad we did it. And that night we went to a bar where we had often gone, have a beer, relax, kind of quite the day, and didn't think much about anything in particular other than let's go have a beer. Well, it turned out the 10 o'clock news came on. The first thing was the news on this local demonstration. I was the spokesman interviewed on TV, and all of a sudden it got real quiet in the bar.
Oh, dear.
And all of a sudden people were making little hand signals or pointing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the bartender went underneath the cash register to get something. And we were starting to get pretty nervous and wasn't sure what was happening, and thought it might be a weapon. Well, we just didn't know. And anyway, he got out a photograph of a lynching that had happened nearby in a town 8 miles away called Marion, Indiana, in the 30s, and passed it around the room. And people were making comments on it and this and that, and then making comments about us. The only thing worse than in the use of N-word was a N-word lover, and it wasn't about the word being loved. Anyway, they handed it to me and said, "What do you think of this?" And I said, "It was the most obscene thing I've ever seen." And there was long, long silence. And then someone cracked a joke or made some people laugh. I don't quite know what the comment was. And we just got out of there right away. But I had never experienced white racism quite as dramatically as that. It was like a scene from a movie.
Yeah, it must have been quite the moment. You were going to tell us another story?
To get a little more up to date about issues of civil rights, part of my own biography is I spent a good 10 years of my life not exercising a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I then had a job at the University of California where I started playing basketball again, something I'd done some in my youth, but not real well or a whole lot of. Anyway, I got addicted to playing, lost a bunch of weight, found out I was a much better basketball player than I ever thought I would be. But the funding ran out on that job, and for a while I was unemployed or consulting or freelancing or whatever, and looking for places to play basketball since I was no longer a university employee and couldn't get into their facilities anymore. And anyway, I noticed a court that had, in a public park that had a full court game going on, just what I was looking for, and I wound up going there and quickly being accepted. I played well enough and even picked up the nickname of Silky in the process. But I also started learning things about police that I never quite knew before. I mean, I knew theoretically about how they harass people or cherry pick or whatever. But there was one particular incident when almost all the players there were black, except for me. We were finished playing, and we were heading to my car. I was giving some of them a ride or something innocent like that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the police wanted IDs of all of us. And I said, why? And he claimed jaywalking. Now, this was by a public park on a not terribly important street. If it were the main drag, the other direction, maybe it could be a legitimate concern. But it was just like the...
A residential street somewhere in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Just like, again, and Oakland, incidentally, just recently changed the policy, a policy of stopping cars if their one taillight was out or one of their turn signals didn't work or there's a nick on their headlight. And anyway, I, a number of times, started having experiences, especially if I had black people in my car with me or was in a black person's car, of that kind of, well, let's see if we can get someone who has a warrant out for him. I don't know how many times, but at least two or three times, I was stopped for the at a stop sign, not coming to a full stop before the first of two lines at an intersection are in California configurations of markings on streets. And I mean, you're not hurting anyone. It was maybe 6 inches of, and I did come to a full stop, but not on this side of that line rather than that side of that line. And that's the type of thing that black people in Oakland and lots of places have experienced in one way or another, whether it's stop and frisk in New York or whether it's come up with an excuse to harass people or make them feel not wanted. And the whole heart of the civil rights movement was an understanding that people should be treated with dignity, that they should be treated as equals, and that skin color or racial identity or religious identity or sexual identity, all of those things should be irrelevant. Human rights are human rights, and I hope that people can, if they don't share my kind of opinions, to look in their soul and recognize how important it is to be treated with dignity and respect.
Oh, for sure. You know, and having been, and I'm not even black, just a person that looked a little bit different in the 60s, I had a lot of those experiences where the police, in particular the police, were very difficult. They would, if you were in L.A., they had these helicopters and they would pin you in a pool of light and say, don't move until somebody come and shake you down. I was shaken down hitchhiking, and one time I was going to my mother's house in Newport, California, and she'd left the back door open, and I'd been traveling, so I had a backpack with me and things like that, and came into the back door and started to put my things down. Police came in right behind me without knocking or anything, had their guns out, just because they didn't like how I looked in that neighborhood. And, you know, those kind of things happened a lot. Now, today, I like to think that the police are different. But that's because I'm different, too, right? I'm now an old person. I look like everybody else. And, you know, it's really hard to know if things are different or not. But certainly, well, I'm not treated that way anymore. And it makes you wonder a little bit if things have changed that much or not.
When it comes to police brutality, unfortunately, one thing has changed. Or, well, no, I should say fortunately one thing has changed, and that's video cameras.
Yes, thank God.
Those of us who were part of the liberal left, you might say, were aware of black friends telling us of their experience of police brutality and inappropriate behavior. But it's only since people had phones with cameras, largely, that how prevalent it is of people being killed in their own backyard for looking at a cell phone. And one of my connections with this kind of tragedy is I knew Oscar Grant, who was killed in a BART station in Oakland in cold blood.
Killed by police or something?
Killed by a police officer of the transit district who claimed he thought he was using his taser. But he...
You mean he accidentally pulled his gun instead?
He got a manslaughter charge got off after 6 months or something like that. Unfortunately, sometimes people in their instinct are so afraid or so hateful that they are ready to pull a trigger before they should even think about it. I know there's not much time.
A lot of examples of that.
It's way too many. Way too many.
Yeah.
And often they start over really trivial things. The thing in New York about the choking death that was over a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And other things of similar small.
The little child that was killed with a toy gun.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like unbelievable. So can you fill us in sort of like, so we had the Voting Rights Act, LBJ brought that in, Martin Luther King would have been killed just prior to that?
No, he was still alive. The Voting Rights Act was 65, he was killed in 68.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But in those particular years, they were difficult years for King. He went north to Chicago and had terrible confrontations there, things thrown at him, bricks and what have you, just didn't have the organizational skill happening that happened in the South. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference and a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee were strict in their training and discipline of nonviolence and organizing. They were serious. This was, mm-hmm. but they went north and that kind of stuff just
that support
didn't
system
happen.
Wasn't there.
It wasn't there, and the hostility was there in ugly ways. But let's talk about after the real impact of the civil rights movement was in the 70s and 80s, and that there was much more of a presence of blacks on television, in the mm-hmm. movie industry, in politics, and often quite positive. In music, of course, really many did quite prominent roles. The black middle class picked up as more went to college and more got jobs through affirmative action and other means. But somehow, both economic forces where in our country more and more money is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, and social forces made the type of discipline or the type of new life that I thought would happen in this country to happen. Things like guns and things about laws regarding things like marijuana just had a lot to do with much of King's dream not being realized.
Yeah.
And with the present administration in Washington, it seems like it's being reneged upon in one way or another almost every day.
And not only are there these freak murders on the part of the police, but it's so obvious statistically about how many more black people are incarcerated than white for the same habit patterns, same amount of drug usage and so forth. And yet, what is it, 4 out of 5 are black that get actually jail time and so forth?
Yeah, the statistics are alarming, and so much of it was fostered by well-meaning Democrats who wanted to pretend they were tough on law and order.
Yep.
And not understanding much about what communities do when they have underground economies related to things not only drugs but gambling and that. The disruption to American families based on mass incarceration is a scandal.
Yeah, it really is. and you were talking about Stop and Frisk. That was a Bloomberg program that he started, and then it was picked up from New York, and other people started, other states started applying at other cities. Yeah,
I don't think it started with him. I think it started with Giuliani. And maybe even
I know
before,
he gets blamed a lot, but
well, he's blameworthy if anyone ever was.
No, I meant Bloomberg, or did you mean Bloomberg?
Bloomberg. Well, Bloomberg continued it and defended it strongly.
Yes.
And again, it was predominantly used against Black and Latino people, and is an affront to human dignity. And it resulted in very little finding of weapons or forbidden material. But we should not have to live with the understanding that a policeman can come and want to search us and see our ID for no reason at all.
Yeah.
And that's what, it allegedly made New York City a safer place and all that, but it's racist and it's just beyond basic civil rights as I see it.
Any other thoughts about modern civil rights? How the movement is today?
Well, it's hard to tell how it expresses itself and where, and I'm hoping for a better day, but I'm scared by a society in which there are so many guns prevalent and also so many screens prevalent, screens of cell phones and iPads and all that, and what people are relating to is important. Those screens are great, I guess, if it's a way of getting knowledge of stuff. I'm an old news junkie, and all of a sudden I have access to 7 or 8 important papers and all that stuff you can get on Smart News and that. But if people aren't confronting that society is still confronted with issues of fair treatment of everyone and of quality education and of back in the 1950s, people don't realize this, but when Eisenhower was president, the highest tax rate was 91%.
Yes.
And there was nowhere near as many people with massive billions of dollar fortunes. And now, even for the highest of them, it's what, 37 maybe?
I think so, yeah.
And at the lower end of our economy are people just struggling to make ends meet, struggling to have enough for rent and all of that. And it's just, in many ways, a less fair society than many of us thought we might have by now.
It seems like today a lot of the movement aspect of things is around voting rights. There's a lot of places where there's real effort being made to get people registered to vote and to protect those rights. And on the other side, there's a lot of pushback about that, too.
Well, part of the Southern strategy that the Republican Party has had since the days of Richard Nixon is voter suppression.
Mm-hmm.
And that means Black voter suppression and minority voter suppression.
Yep.
And that probably changed the results in the Georgia gubernatorial election last time around, and has long been an issue. And going back to Bush versus Gore, a lot of people were illegally taken off the voting rolls in Florida back in those days if they found slight discrepancies between how your driver's license name and your voter registration name were and things like that.
They're doing a lot of that today with the voter ID.
Sure. There's really an effort to suppress the vote, and therefore that means suppressing the basic right of citizenship.
Well, Bob, we're getting close to the end of our time, and I know you had some writings and some things you wanted to share with people online. Was website Progressive Christianity? Yeah, Would you say a little bit about what's available there?
There is a website called progressivechristianity.org. That's all lower letters, and on that there are various things of mine, including some of my writings about the March on Washington and civil rights days. And also there's a video of the homily I gave in Brookings for the 50th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King. And all of those are just when it comes to their search tool, just click in last name and put in O'Sullivan, and those things can all be found.
That's great. And also, you're planning to have some events coming up in Black History Month, which is February, I believe.
Yeah, we're in some contact with local educational people about events either related to the Martin Luther King birthday holiday or Black History Month, and at different levels of education. And as things develop, I'm sure the people here at KCIW would be willing to help publicize it.
Oh, for sure. And also, some of those things are going to be going on at the college, most likely.
So definitely
check the college schedule. And there's going to be some really interesting things in the works that are being planned right now. So hopefully that all comes together and people can check it out. Bob, it's been great having you on once again. You're just so knowledgeable about all of this, and you've had that personal experience too, which makes it so much more interesting. I want to thank you and thank Pi White, our co-producer and technical support. This has been Lee Tooley for Reality Check on KCIW. Thank you very much for listening.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.